What is hospitality anyway? And why do we have it? Where did it start? Well, I remember them in Paris, using the alcoves by the river as makeshift ballrooms, finding dance partners in strangers. Quite big crowds they formed between the participants and the onlookers. They waltzed and tangoed. Had they chosen a different style of music, they could have danced without the complication of touching people they didn't know. This was very different to the euphoria of raves, where social awkwardnesses were obliterated. In those illicit corners, we were neurotransmitted straight into collective consciousness, dancing exquisitely alone together. We longed to erase the boundaries of our bodies, to burrow deeper and deeper into the ritual until we forgot where we ended and others began. What need had we for language? There was nothing to say or prove. We were beyond identity, social status or belief systems, wholly detached from plans and strategies. We were atoms and molecules pulsating in warehouses or motorway underpasses, huddling together for survival like a ball of bees. In Paris, it was different. Here, the dancers overtly pursued physical encounter, the reversible double sensation of touching and being touched. They were self-conscious in their advances, navigating the lumpy terrain from spiny stranger to dance partner. They used open spaces and made a spectacle of their maladroitness, like a clunky mating ritual. They seemed to enjoy having the river there flowing past, an indifferent witness. I noticed them in other places across the city too, fashioning impromptu ganguettes in front of fountains and facades of grand opera houses, sometimes even just traffic islands. They piled their possessions and entrusted them to the collective peripheral vision, emboldened by nocturnal catharsis, agreeing to trust each other with their bodies, to suspend language, to move together, not minding about the light layer of dusty urban grease that coated everyone, not minding about heavy hearts. They knew enough to know that they needed to hold on to each other, and there was nothing much they could say. These scenes mesmerize me. I am here in Paris on an artist residency at the Centre Culturel Irlandais to think and dream. I'm also working intensely, programming a food discussion tent for a festival about the climate crisis called Earth Rising. During an early brainstorming meeting in May, the term 60 more harvests was used by my fellow programmer. I heard this at the time, but psychologically filed it away in the category of things I can't think about / hopefully are not real. It's not until 3 months later, in Paris, watching people dance by the Seine, that I revisit this phrase. Something in the way the strangers are reaching for each other is evoking end days and eliciting tears. This feeling of sadness is likely heightened by my recent professional deep dive into food in the Anthropocene. I root around for the origins and validity of this 60 more harvest claim. It emerged in 2014 during a United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization forum, but is not attributed to anyone in particular. There was another linked quote about how it takes 1,000 years to produce an inch of soil. I want to encounter disputing articles, and of course I do, because that is what life on the internet is like. One could get hung up on the exact quantity of years left to grow food on Earth, but what registers with me is the sense of an ending, the certainty that we will not live like this for much longer. If the 450 billion years of the Earth is a year, we humans appeared at 11:35 p.m. on New Year's Eve, and we have been receiving unconditional hospitality ever since. Eons, eras, epochs. There is skewed consolation in this deep time. If we humans shrink in relevance, does the damage we cause reduce proportionately? There is a heavy hope that after our gracious host, the Earth, finally sees the back of us, there will be a process of restoration, a worldwide cleansing and rewilding, with whatever species resilient enough to endure, and without us. I have underlying grief and guilt and shame, and it weighs heavy, especially now the more I learn. These are pointless, energy-sucking feelings, I know. I grope around helplessly in the enormity of it. It is a problem that can't be measured. The term hyperobject is used to describe the unfathomable legacy of waste materials, such as polystyrene and plutonium, which will far outlast current social and biological forms. Hyperobject invoke a terror beyond the sublime, cutting deeper than conventional religious fear. Michael Cronin likens the climate crisis to a hyperobject in its inability to be grasped in totality. We get glimpses, all right. The perpetual stillness of the creatures we are stamping out is hard. We have been bad guests. We have forgotten the necessary humility of earthlings. The consciousness of beings who realize that they only have one planet and whose well-being is crucially dependent on the well-being and intelligibility of all other entities for whom the Earth is also home. We progressed from energy beings to extractivist colonizers. We wiped things out to get more, and we turned on one another with shameful cruelty over things that won't have mattered a damn in the end. Yes, we were bad. It wasn't everyone, however, and it wasn't all the time. There are those that oppose the term Anthropocene on the grounds that it holds all of humanity accountable for the damage done. This is particularly objectionable to Indigenous communities who do not generally drive fossil fuel economy or practice intensive agriculture and are not being consulted for their valuable insight now in the strategizing discourse. In considering the aftermath of our species and our repugnant legacy, it seems important to commit it to memory that there were some redeeming features. I do not mean to defend or excuse us. That would be unthinkably crass. Perhaps my motivation is more to add a layer of complexity to the detritus we will leave in our wake, an appendage to the polystyrene artifacts. There was dreadful harm caused, yes, but this dark process was punctuated by some extraordinarily beautiful glitches. There were split-second flashes of light, moments of solace, of connection, of pure love. I believe that these ballroom dancers in Paris are creating such a glitch. I need different information. So I embark on an expedition to the François Mitterrand branch of the National Library of France. I want to understand why strangers are holding onto each other in the streets. I didn't say this at the reception. I decide to approach this glitch as a manifestation of hospitality. Because it involves strangers and risk, I begin with Lucy Rigare, who looks at the dramaturgy of meeting strangers and positions us humans as guests in nature. She also strongly advocates for leaving language out of hospitality exchanges. This wordlessness is ringing a bell. My dancers by the river are operating independently of verbal exchange. I consult Richard Carney on the role of touch and physical gestures because I believe that this phenomenon of strangers holding one another in the middle of the city, this timely discarding of words, is telling us something. He calls it carnal hospitality. Out of courtesy, I check in with Derrida. There is poignant tension in the interaction of these dancers that is reminding me of the tension between the law of hospitality and the laws of society. Derrida is arguing that the law of hospitality, that is, to give without asking, is unfeasible in our daily lives. I am looking to poke holes in this claim based on what I have seen unfold in these informal ballrooms. Unexpected, ill-advised trust in the stranger. These meetings require a relinquishing of suspicion and require participants to revert to open-hearted earthlings. What is hospitality anyway? And why do we have it? Where did it start? Well, we didn't always live like this in big cities. We used to be more scattered. We used to live in small country villages and have nearly everything we needed in one place and all our friends and relatives close by so we could wave at each other and gossip and fancy the big, strong blacksmith. Hospitality is not an industry. It is part of our human condition. It's hardwired into us as a species. We know it because we receive it from the earth. We get it unconditionally in the womb. It is fizzy, vibrant, thrilling, full of life, living. It means that when we reach the end of our lives, we have a full feeling. We are satisfied that we have complicated situations around us in interesting ways. We have filled our days with possibility. We have risked well. When we die, we take nothing with us, except the mesmerizing tangle of connections we formed while we were here, the lives we touched, the people who interrupted us, the sparks we ignited. Hospitality is how we did that.